Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 73 of the Alabama Liberal Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about United States of Exhaustion. I actually recorded episode 73, which was a different topic. It's about Trump's base, but I did that about, I think I finished it literally about an hour before Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. So I recorded this podcast, then I was like, oh, this is a pretty good episode. I'll edit this later, post it sometime over the weekend. Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies. That plan goes out the window, and I'm like, okay, let me maybe take episode 73, and I'll put it episode 74. Whatever episode comes out that's mostly about Trump's base, probably the next one or whenever I can find a good place for it. If it doesn't mention anything about Ginsburg, that's because I recorded it before she died. I thought it would be weird to go ahead and run that episode anyway at 73 and not mention Ginsburg's death at all, the biggest news story out there. It might be like, well, why didn't he mention that at all and how this is shaking up the race and everything. So you never can plan anything with a podcast, especially in the era of Trump. You never know what's going to happen or if there's going to be a huge news story or something break down, but United States of Exhaustion, there's two meanings for it. Number one, it's a little bit off the stages of grief, which some people think are the five stages of death. And of course, there's really only one stage of death, which is you die and that's it. But they really mean like the five stages of learning you're about to die. Some people call it the five stages of grief. And of course, that's denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and finally acceptance. Some people never get to acceptance. They die before then. But that applies to where we're at right now in 2020. And there's also just the pure fact of exhaustion from how bad the news has been. I sometimes tell people that one of the many reasons the episodes have been so sporadic this time out and maybe not as consistent as the first season. First season felt like almost a fun romantic comedy, right? The love affair between myself and Michael. I mean, Hillary and the electorate, of course, but it was a romp. You had Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and that was a really fun Democratic primary debate. On the Republican side, you had Trump and 15 other opponents. So it was him versus this army of opponents, everybody wanting to take Trump down. Could they do it? Could they not do it? So you had two generally interesting primaries. And then when you got to the main race and it was Trump, which some people didn't know if he'd be a brokered convention. Some people didn't know if he'd have to resign because of the pussy grab thing and Pence would have to be the nominee. That dynamo of raw charisma that is Mike Pence, all that razzle dazzle he's got pinned up. How exciting would that be, right? And then Hillary, right? Many scandals with her about the emails and James Comey and at 9/11, did she faint? Was Hillary Clinton on death's door? So it felt kind of interesting. It felt kind of fun and a little bit exciting. And at that time, nobody really believed that Trump had a chance of beating her. So it wasn't quite scary yet at that point. Fast forward to 2020, and we have a very different scenario. We have an aspiring tyrant as the president. He's the incumbent. He's running as an incumbent, and even though I've laid out why I think this is the worst possible conditions for an incumbent running for re-election, there is a chance he could win. I don't think anybody's saying that there's no way he could win. Not necessarily because he won the popular vote, which most people think is impossible, and not necessarily because I even believe he won the Electoral College, but because Trump could cheat. He's trying every possible way he can to cheat and rig this election. It's not a typical election in that it's going to be who has the most votes. It's going to really come down to turnout. And it's going to come down to all the votes for Joe Biden. Are they actually going to be counted? Are they actually going to be received in time? I could easily see Biden getting 1 million votes or whatever it is from mail-in balloting that show up late. And then election night, Trump goes out there and declares himself the winner. And there's still 2 or 3 weeks of mail-in ballots and absentee ballots that need to be counted before you can even really know who the winner is. But he's rushing as fast as he can to get certified. I could easily see that happening. And I think Democrats are going to have to prepare for a lot of things that could happen like that. So it is a different scenario. You have an incumbent president that's very unpopular, extremely divisive, incompetent, dangerous, stupid. I say aspiring tyrant and people laugh. It's kind of a joke, but it is true. Trump is already saying that not only does he think he's going to win a second term, he talks about it as though he's already won. And that's what scares me the most. He doesn't seem to even think he could lose, which is what really scares me. But when you see him being interviewed, last week he talked about that he would ask the Congress for a third term. He floated the idea of having a third term and said he'd ask the Congress for one. Lord knows I deserve one. This is scary. It really is a different scenario, even with just Trump himself. Then when you add in coronavirus, 200,000 Americans dead, more every day, George Floyd and the race riots, pandemics, shutdowns, unemployments. It is a very different scenario than the final year of the Obama administration, which almost seems like fun and games at this point. It seems like a game of chutes and ladders, and Trump seems like a game of chicken. We're barreling right towards an 18-wheeler that's honking its fucking guts out at us, and are we going to blink? Are we going to turn? Are we going to run right into it? So that's really where we're at. The stakes were high enough as already. You know, this was already a depressing year. I think most people are exhausted. But then Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies. Now, this is already, I would argue, this is the most pivotal presidential election since 1932, since FDR Hoover, when you had the Great Depression. And Hoover famously didn't want to get involved in World War II. He didn't think that was any of our business. He was somewhat, I wouldn't say sympathetic to Nazis, but he didn't want to challenge them directly. He was definitely more sympathetic to them than FDR was. FDR, you had World War II on the line. You had the Great Depression. You had, could more people fall underground? I really believe this is the most pivotal election since then. And some people might say that it's even more than that. It's even going back to 1860. Since Abraham Lincoln's been on the damn ballot, we haven't had a race this pivotal. We've just never seen anything like this. We thought that Al Gore and George W. Bush, we thought that was a big deal, and I believe it was a big deal. And then we might have thought that Barack Obama and John McCain was a big deal. We always say things like, this is the most important presidential race in our lifetimes. We've said that several cycles over and over again. I truly believe this is. I really believe that this is the biggest race in decades, probably since at least the 60s, I would say since the 30s, and some would say since the 1860s. That's how important this is. As if it wasn't sky high enough, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is dead. You know, as if we needed more pressure, as if we needed one more thing to be on red alert about and nervous about, as if the stakes weren't high enough. Now we have the fate of the courts as we know it. Now, people might think, well, it's one more justice. The same thing happened with Scalia in 2016. True and not true at the same time. With Scalia, you had a conservative justice that was replaced by Neil Gorsuch. Not really a downgrade. Scalia for Gorsuch is pretty much the same thing. Gorsuch may be slightly more reasonable, maybe 5% more reasonable than Scalia. It mattered in terms of, can we get somebody liberal on there? Could we replace Scalia with Justice Stacey Abrams? Wouldn't that be great, right? Like, that would be amazing. And that would have been really great and exciting. At the same time, it didn't totally change the court's makeup. This changes the court's makeup in a way that for Democrats and liberals is terrifying. It should be scary. It should scare you to death. Right now, there's five conservative justices, only four liberals. You have Breyer, Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and then the deceased RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Some people say the notorious RBG. I would say the notoriously stubborn RBG, because everyone was afraid of this. And Obama's second term, they practically begged her, please, for the love of God, step down. Let him replace you with a younger justice. A lot of people think Bill Clinton made a mistake appointing her because she was already so old. I mean, she was pretty old when Bill Clinton appointed her. She was in her 60s, and a lot of justices, they've been going younger and younger. I mean, pretty soon there's going to be like a 25-year-old justice. The next Supreme Court justice is going to be younger than me probably, right? Like, they'll be in their early 30s or late 20s or something, because they've been kind of going younger and younger. I mean, it'll be the fucking Disney TV movie star up next. Like, that'll be the next one they get. But they like younger and younger justices because they want them to stay on there for decades. So Bill Clinton appoints Ruth Bader Ginsburg at a time when I believe she was 60, and some people thought she was already too old to be on the court. But then Obama gets elected. His first term, they say, like, Ruth, are you thinking about stepping down? No, I'm not. His second term, Ruth, please, for the love of God, you're 80 years old. Because keep in mind, she died now. She was 87. This has only been 4 years. So in Obama's second term, she would have already been 80 years old. And she's already had multiple bouts of cancer. She wasn't in great shape to begin with. Pictures of her and video, she looks like a skeleton, even before she died. This is years ago. This is 5-6 years ago. People are saying, Ruth, please step down. Let him replace you with, I believe there was a judge named Nina that ran marathons and was in her 40s and could live forever and was really confident about it. And Ruth would always kind of be like, you know, a little bit of a typical baby boomer narcissist. Like, she'd say, well, who else would you want on the court except for me? And she'd have like kind of a smirk or whatever, you know, that typical Fran Lebowitz, like, who else is better than I am, right? And it's like, well, there's a lot of people. There's thousands of liberal justices that could take your place tomorrow and would be better, because then we're not constantly having this death watch, vulture in the air atmosphere of like, oh my God, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's got the flu. Oh my God, she's been hospitalized for a hangnail. Do we have to, should we send the ambulance over? Like, people were so hyperprotective of her. They wanted to measure, like, you know, oh, how hot is her soup? Is it too hot? Is it going to burn the roof? Burning the roof of her mouth could kill her. She's too fucking old, and she had been for years. She fell down a flight of stairs and broke 3 ribs at one point, and I remember her cult of young white women being like, oh, you really think that could kill Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Like, she's a superhero. Like, she's Wonder Woman. The woman's had cancer 3 times, and she's 80-something years old. I think sneezing on her the wrong way could fucking kill her, okay? So she's stubborn as hell. She won't step down. Now we've got what everybody was afraid would happen, which is that she would die in Trump's first term, and we've been afraid of this. She'd been fighting a fourth bout of cancer in private for months. Apparently, she'd been sick for many months, but they hid that. They had hid her latest health struggles and things like that for good reason, because they knew Republicans would do everything they could to push her out. Now she's dead with only 6 weeks to go until the election. And the reason it's such a big deal is because you have 5 conservative justices right now and 4 liberals, Ginsburg being the 4th if she were alive. If they replace her with another conservative justice, Trump will, he'll go full conservative. He'll go Ted Cruz. He'll go Tom Cotton. He's not going to go for a moderate. I mean, I'm already anticipating Supreme Court Justice Tom Cotton or Ted Cruz. Trump said, I'd like to appoint a woman. Woman to him is probably like Michelle Bachmann or somebody like that. I mean, it's probably to the right of any woman I've ever met. I mean, it could be Sarah Palin or something, or a TV evangelist wife. I mean, that's who I'm anticipating he'll pick. He'll be the most conservative female judge that the court has ever had, if he's allowed to pick who he wants to pick. Then you'll have 5 conservative block of judges, you know, Clarence Thomas and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and his new pick. And then you're going to go over there to the Democratic side, even if Judge Roberts flips over, because people say, oh, Judge Roberts, he's such a disappointment. He voted to uphold Obamacare, and he's voted to uphold several controversial rulings. They're not really that controversial. He's not anything like a liberal. He's a very conservative judge. 30 years ago, he'd be the most conservative judge on the court, but it's just because of the way the court has shifted in the makeup of who Republicans have been appointing. But even if Judge Roberts, even if he sides with Stephen Breyer and Sotomayor and Lanny Kagan, even if he does, who cares? Because they outvote him on everything. It'll be 5-4 on everything. And that means even if Joe Biden gets a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House of Representatives, and there's a Democratic wave in November, that means even if he gets the Congress he wants, if they put forth something like Obamacare, and then they eventually kick it up to the Supreme Court, it'll get overturned. So no matter what his Democratic Congress is able to do, without having Roberts as a swing vote, and of course Kennedy's been replaced by Kavanaugh, who's a fucking maniac and everything, so without anything resembling an actual swing vote on the court with a 6-3 conservative majority, even if they get Roberts to flip, it won't make a difference, and they'll overturn every single thing he's trying to do. I also think Republicans want to fill this vacancy as fast as they can. I saw Ted Cruz, he unwittingly kind of gave the game away, because he was like, well, we need a Supreme Court that's fully stocked because this election could be contested and we need people to... He's basically saying, what if 2000 happens? Bush versus Gore, for those of you that might have forgotten, go back and watch the TV movie Recount, where Bush versus Gore were really angling in Florida, and it was all coming into Florida, and they had a recount, and then the Supreme Court was able to come in and stop the recount, which was outrageous and crazy. If you go and watch the Netflix documentary about Roger Stone, it looks as though Roger Stone played a part in having them bum rush the recount and shut that down and all the protesters coming in. It's actually a very sordid tale that involves Roger Stone and a lot of people that have become Trump confidants that know quite a bit about stealing elections. That's what they specialize in, which is why I'm a little hopeful about the Lincoln Project guys, because some of those same guys, those are the Republican hatchetmen and dirty tricksters, and Lord knows we need them. We need the Republican hatchetmen and dirty tricksters, because Democrats suck at this shit. I mean, we are just not good at this. We need those people who know how to scheme and steal a race and an election. You had the Supreme Court come in and stop the 2000 recount and shut it down. Republicans, they might be like, well, we need that 6-3 conservative majority. So even if Roberts agrees with the 3 liberals, then we can still come in and shut down a recount and steal the race and the election, and if the election's contested. But of course, that's a conflict of interest. If Trump is allowed to appoint a judge, and even if it's a female judge, but we'll say unknown conservative woman number 5, Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin, if he's allowed to appoint her and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, that's 3 justices out of 9 that he's personally appointed to the court that are going to be deciding the race and the election. Now, you would think a normal judge would recuse themselves, but we know how Trump feels about recusals. Jeff Sessions is famously lambasted. The whole reason he's out of the Senate is because Trump believes he betrayed him by recusing himself and doing the right thing and, you know, surrendering to a conflict of interest. So Trump hated him so bad he went out there and campaigned for Tupperville. We all know how he feels about that. First question he's going to ask anybody who's up for a judgeship under him is, would you recuse yourself if it was a conflict of interest or anything having to do with me, my taxes, the election, whether I should go to jail, so on and so on. And that judge better say no, or they're going to be off his Supreme Court shortlist. And he can tell if they mean no or not. Kavanaugh and Gorsuch have shown, shockingly, that they don't care about conflicts of interest. You might remember my interview with Mike Breuer. He talked about Judge Kavanaugh and Mitch McConnell were out there campaigning in Kentucky. Most Supreme Court justices wouldn't go out there and campaign with the senator in an election year. They would think that was a little tasteless. Not Kavanaugh. That's the whole reason he's on the damn Supreme Court. That's the whole reason Trump fought like a lion to keep him on there. The second all this stuff broke out about date rape in college and high school and things like that, and him being a drunk and all these indiscretions, they could have pulled him and replaced him with a justice just as conservative, just as crazy, but They liked that Kavanaugh had a spine, that he fought it, that he wouldn't step down, that he wouldn't bow down to pressure. They like that he could be their man, unequivocally and totally. Of course, that's what Trump's going to be looking for if he tries to fill out that replacement. So it is a really big deal. And right now, we need at least four Republicans, at least four, to say, we're not going to vote on a replacement for Ginsburg. Now, so far, Chuck Grassley, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski, they have said that. Right now, it looks like McConnell doesn't have the votes to go forward with a replacement for Ginsburg, so far. But that could change Susan Collins. You know how she is. If she changes her mind and it's 50-50 in the Senate, Mike Pence can break the tie or whatever it is. So it's really important that all of them hold firm, and then maybe a couple of others like Cory Gardner. But here's a problem. A lot of Republican senators are up for election this year. I mean, a lot of them. Twice as many Republicans are up this year as Democrats. Some of the so-called swing votes that they're counting on, like Cory Gardner and Susan Collins and people like that, they're up this year. So you have multiple scenarios that could be gamed out. One is, what if they lose and then they don't give a shit? So between November and January, they rush through a justice regardless of whether they have any right to or not. They lose their race and they think, well, this is one big fuck you on my way out the door. What if they win, but Trump loses? And at that point, they've won re-election. They're safe for six more years. Someone like Susan Collins, she doesn't have a political future. If she can squeak by this time, this will be the last time she ever does. Her and McConnell both, a lot of Republicans are so old they're finished. Chuck Grassley, the same thing. So no matter what happens, they might be like, well, Trump lost, but we didn't. So what if Trump loses, but they maintain the Senate and they rush it through? What if they lose, but Trump wins, which I don't think will happen, but let's just say the nightmare of nightmares happens or whatever. They might rush it through as a fuck you to the American people. What if they both lose, but they still rush it through as a fuck you to the American people? Because it's not like they're above doing that. Keep in mind, they've had 6 months to pass a second stimulus in an election year where there's twice as many Senate Republicans as Democrats up, and they still don't give a shit. That's how much they don't care about popular opinion or what the American people want or what's best for the American people. They don't give a shit. Mitch McConnell's up for re-election. You'd think he'd be more motivated than anybody to pass a second stimulus. You'd think he'd be more motivated than anybody to say, we're not going to have a vote because that would make me a blatant hypocrite given what I did 4 years ago. He does not care. Period. He doesn't care. He's already come out and said, if Trump puts a nominee up, we're going to try to rush it into a vote. And then if it loses, it loses. He doesn't care that this could blow up in his face, that he could lose re-election. Him and Trump are running as though they've already won, which is very scary to me personally. It's like they know something we don't, like they've already done something to where they know the outcome of the race. McConnell's race is pretty close. Trump is losing his race. In every single poll, he's down by 10 points. Early voting has already started in some states. His race has already begun. They don't seem to care that this could backfire in their face, that every single person could say, well, in 2016, Anton Scalia died in February. So from February to November, you had 8 months between when he died and the election, and you refused to even allow a hearing on Merrick Garland, even allow him to be interviewed. No Republican senator even met with him. No Republican senator even said we should be voting on this. 8 months went by without a single movement on Merrick Garland. No hearings, no meetings, no nothing. Absolutely nothing. But now it's 6 weeks until the election. Some states have already begun early voting. And the same people being like, hey, we can't have a Supreme Court being filled in an election year. The American people, they need to make this decision. Exact same people are now in a time when early voting has already begun, at a time when people are going to have to mail in absentee ballots weeks ahead of time, when coronavirus has shut down polling places. Exact same people are saying, let's go ahead and have a vote. Let's let Trump appoint somebody as fast as he can. Let's not only have hearings and meetings and ask questions, let's go ahead and vote on this, which is fucking insane. It's bananas. If you were against it when it was an 8 month time period between February to November, how in the hell do you justify that from late September to the first 3 days of November? How in God's name can you justify that blatant level of hypocrisy? Lisa Murkowski came out and said, fair is fair. We can't justify this. We can't do something 4 years ago and then do something totally different now. It makes no sense, especially when it's an even more condensed time frame, especially when it really makes no sense. Early voting has already begun. Susan Collins has come out and said, people have to believe that their government will operate consistently. It's all about consistency. If you're against it in 2016, you can't be for it now. Chuck Grassley and Mitt Romney have said similar things. You would think this would be a slam dunk, and yet Mitch McConnell's going to go ahead and rush a vote through anyway. Now, if he rushes a vote through, knowing that they're going to lose, because right now, from what people have said publicly, it doesn't look like he has the votes. right? So why would he go ahead and rush through a vote on that anyway, knowing they don't have the votes and knowing that it's the worst of both worlds? The conservatives are not going to get what they want, which is a majority Supreme Court conservative justice, solid. Not Roberts is not even on the consideration anymore. So they don't get what they want on that end. But then the swing voters and the independent voters, they're going to look at it and say, but this is complete hypocrisy. You did something totally different 4 years ago. Like, this is very easy to point to Lindsey Graham, who gave an interview saying that if Ruth Bader Ginsburg were to die, it wouldn't be Trump's, during the election, it would not be Trump's place to appoint her successor. He would hold steady to what he said back in 2016. The same rules would apply. Very easy to paint him as a total damn hypocrite, and his race is fairly close. So it could be the few thousand votes he would need to lose to Jamie Harrison. So you have to think, like, several of these senators, Cory Gardner, Susan Collins, Lindsey Graham, I mean, they're fighting very close, very tough races. Why would he force a vote like that that could blow up in their face? Maybe he doesn't think it will. Mitch McConnell's an evil genius. He sits and considers all the angles. And so there must be something in it where he thinks not only are we going to get the judge we want, but it's not even going to make a difference for the few thousand voters that in these tough districts. It worries me that he's not concerned about this. I know we've talked about Mitch McConnell doesn't give a shit, but that was always against Obama. That was always when the voters of Kentucky and the voters in a lot of these redder than red states that Republicans control, well, Obama sucks and we can do whatever we want and we can treat him terribly and we can run all over him. Like, they were always able to do that with Obama because their voters didn't care what he did to them. This is a little different in that Trump is the current president. We all know that typically the party of the president, they lose seats. The country turns Democratic when Bush is in office, when Trump is in office, right? Like, the more a Republican president is in power, the more Democratic the country gets. And vice versa is also somewhat true. People have a Democratic president and they start thinking, hey, well, I voted for Obama. How come I don't have a unicorn? How come my fridge is not full of prime rib and filet mignon? How come I was a postman when I voted for Obama and right now I'm not a movie producer? So the standards become outrageous under Democratic presidents. Then with a Republican president, it's like, holy shit, people are dying. The economy shut down where nothing's getting done. It's really pandemonium. So they start turning Democratic. You would think McConnell would know this, and yet it very much concerns me that he doesn't seem concerned with it. So when you get to the United States of Exhaustion, first you have denial. Denial is basically being like, well, Republicans, there's no way that they're going to basically vote on a Supreme Court justice. I mean, for God's sakes, we've got video clips of Lindsey Graham being like he would be a total hypocrite to vote on a Ginsburg replacement while Trump's being reelected. He's already said he's going to vote on it. So he's already reversed himself after people are being like, well, there's no way he could do that. He'll look like a hypocrite. They don't care. So our denial is basically thinking that Republicans operate in some parallel universe where they care how they come off to people and they give a shit what most people think. And of course, the Republican Party is famously not Democratic anyway. They've lost the popular vote in every election since I've been alive. Not since Dukakis have they had a true blowout in terms of popular vote. Some people say Bush beat John Kerry in 2004's popular vote. I'm not totally convinced that's true, but even if you count 2004, in my lifetime, they've won one popular vote in my lifetime for the United States of the presidency. Yet they've controlled the White House for half that time. Bush in 2000, Trump in 2016. The first 200 years of the nation, only twice did the winner of the popular vote not become president. Now it's happened twice in the last 20 years. So from 1776 all the way to 1996, it happened twice. Now it's happened twice in 16 years of this century. It could very well happen again in 2020. They don't care. You get to the Senate, the Dakotas outvote California. The Senate is ridiculously not Democratic. I mean, it's really absurd to think about. California has got 15% of the whole nation. We have two senators. South Dakota ties us in the Senate in terms of voting power. Montana, South Dakota, North Dakota, Idaho, Utah, Wyoming, all these really small western states, they outvote California and New York and Illinois. Even the House of Representatives, which they always give that argument. Well, yeah, but that's because the Senate is designed for this and that and everything. And the House of Representatives, that's where you really have the people's will being reflected. 2010 was the Tea Party wave, and 2010 was the last census. So because Democrats got routed in 2010, during the Tea Party wave and Obama's first midterm as president, which Democrats always lose really bad in that time period. Bill Clinton did in 1994, same thing with Gingrich. But because that coincided with the census, they drew census maps that were like cubist paintings. They were abstract in many ways. 2012, 14, 16, Nancy Pelosi actually got more votes. The Democrats got more votes. They had about a million more votes on average in those races. They lost the House of Representatives by over a dozen seats. Because that's how badly it was gerrymandered. So even the one that was supposed to reflect population, they did win the majority of the people. In terms of pure population votes, you had all the votes cast for Democrats, all the votes cast for Republicans, and yet they still didn't control the House of Representatives because of gerrymandering. It's not fair, and it's not a fair system. And between Bush and Trump, you will now have, if he's allowed to appoint Ginsburg's replacement, you will have presidents that never won the popular vote that have appointed five Supreme Court justices. The majority of the Supreme Court will have been appointed by presidents who did not win the popular vote, and they will be approved or denied by a Senate that is not elected by the majority of the American people, not even attempted to be represented by a majority of the American people. Does that seem like a fair system to anyone? Republicans are real big on this phrase, elections have consequences. I always hear that, elections have consequences. But do they though? 2000, they lose the popular vote, they become president anyway. 2016, they lose the popular vote by a landslide, they become president anyway. The Senate is controlled by Western states with no people in them. Do elections really have consequences if they can lose the popular vote for the Senate, the House of Representatives, and the presidency, and yet they control everything? They control the full apparatus of the government, and a majority of the Supreme Court is appointed by presidents who didn't win the popular vote and is approved by senators who didn't win the popular vote. Does that sound like a functioning, stable democracy where the will of the people actually listen to an election? Does that have consequences? I think not. That brings us to anger. Anger is what starts to happen when you start to realize that point and you start to get really mad about it. And the outlets for most people are very limited. You can either go on Twitter and rage at the universe and other people who agree with you already, they give you likes and they give you retweets and follows. And some people are just happy doing that. And that's how you see a lot of people on Twitter. I've got 200,000 followers. And then you don't know who they are. They're never on CNN. They're never on TV. They're not pundits or whatever. But they could have a million followers just retweeting the same rage out over and over and over again so that it becomes kind of a vicious cycle. Trump is a war criminal. 10,000 likes and retweets by people who agree with them. Then they get more followers. And they're encouraged to make more and more outrageous statements. The more nuanced statements that I make on Twitter, they get almost no likes, no retweets. I lose followers. The more outrageous, the more one-sided, the more direct, tap to the face, punch to the face that a statement is, the more encouraging that it is. But at the end of the day, you'll be like, oh, wow, this person's big on Twitter. They got 2 million followers. So what? They're not pundits. They don't get paid. They don't write freelance articles. It really is pretty meaningless. But in some way, you're trying to think, well, I can monetize that. I can monetize a ton of followers into something. And then the next part comes where maybe that's not true. You start to move into bargaining. And bargaining becomes like, well, maybe if we just come to the Republicans in bipartisan faith, maybe if we say like, hey guys, it's not right that you did this to Merrick Garland back in 2016 and Merrick Garland got treated so badly. So maybe we can just not do that again this time. And you got us. You kept Merrick Garland off the Supreme Court and you allowed Scalia to be replaced by Gorsuch. So the court still stayed in Republican hands. It was still a conservative majority, but you can see where turnabout's fair play and maybe we should replace Ginsburg with another liberal justice. That way, at least there's a chance that we could win one with Roberts every once in a while. It's still a conservative court, but it's just not, we just don't have a chance at all. Like, it's still like, you know, you'll win two out of every three, but we have a chance this way. Does that sound fair, guys? It's still a better deal for you than for us. No, fuck you. We're not interested in deals. No bargaining. You can't bargain with lunatics. You basically had Obama in his first term. People said things like, why didn't he try to win over the white working class? He did, over and over again. In Obama's first term, he had cash for clunkers. Who do you think that benefits, something like cash for clunkers? You go through the houses in Alabama, you see all kind of yards where there's 8 fucking cars. I used to have people in neighborhoods, I'd see like an abandoned school bus. And so you drive through somebody's house, it's like a damn junkyard. They'd have 2 acres of land. You could see maybe 2 feet of it because there'd be so many fucking car parts and old abandoned cars. An old school bus. What the hell are you going to do with that? A school bus with no wheels parked in the middle of your house like some land cruise boat or something. Some whale made out of metal in somebody's house, right? Felt like, well, that's kind of creepy and ominous. An abandoned school bus. Probably not the kind of people I want as my neighbors. But you'd see literally all these cars. Cash for clunkers benefited rural people. Urban people don't have, they have apartments and they live in public housing or they live in apartments or they don't have room to put car parts out on their lawn. They don't have a lawn to put car parts on. So that benefited rural people. Then you take something like all the stuff he tried to do that didn't work. Medicaid expansion. Tried to pass that. A lot of red state governors said, no, thank you. John Kasich was one of the only ones that took him up on that. He was called a rhino. He went to Bentley in Alabama. Medicaid expansion. Get the hell out of here, Obama. I don't want no part of that. Okay, how about we extend the unemployment benefits? You would have think that Obama owed them money. He was over there trying to give them money. And they were like, no, get away from me. He's trying to steal my wallet. He's trying to take money from me. Stimulus money. They turned it down. When you turn down Medicaid expansions and unemployment extensions and stimulus money, you're just a dick. You're an asshole at that point. Like, he's over there literally trying to help you, and they don't want it, and they won't take it from him, because then it makes it look like Obama cares about red states. That doesn't fit their narrative. They turn it down and won't take it. Then you take something like Obamacare. Now, that's been proven to disproportionately benefit rural people and red state people, because that's where a lot of the uninsured Americans are. Majority of your uninsured Americans or people that, you know, treat the emergency room as their primary provider, they're chicken plant workers, meat packing workers, construction workers, loggers, people that cut off thumbs and fingers and saws and everything else, and they got to go to the emergency room. Who's your healthcare provider? Duct tape. I just usually put a duct tape over the wound where the stump where my thumb is gone. He was trying to help red state people. Even something like the wind project. He was going to use wind from Oklahoma, but they generate a lot of wind over there. And I don't just mean the televangelists who are based out of there that are full of shit. But they generate wind there. And he was going to use basically an electric pipeline that the wind from Oklahoma could be put to Tennessee. So it was like a wind power project where with the grids that we're trying to build, like say in Arizona, it would generate enough solar power to power California. And we would use their solar power. In South Dakota, there'd be a wind farm that was able to power Washington. That's the kind of new projects that we're trying to build. The states that get the most sun and wind, they can power states that don't get as much of that. And we pay them for it. Most of the solar and wind come from red states like Arizona, South Dakota, Oklahoma, and they would get paid for these projects because our energy is coming from them. It's our energy needs. This is a direct improvement over certain projects, like, for example, in Vermont, a lot of their hydroelectric power comes from Canada. So a lot of Vermont is powered by Canada. Well, wouldn't it be great if red states started powering some of the heavier use energy blue states? Wouldn't that be a nice thing for the red states? They'd get more money that way. No, because at that time in Oklahoma, the attorney general was Scott Pruitt, and he sued Obama over and over again trying to prevent this wind pipeline. Now, that made no sense for Oklahoma. That wasn't for their benefit. That was the fossil fuel companies that secretly backed and controlled him. They didn't want Tennessee and the other states to have access to Oklahoma's wind power. They wanted them totally reliant on dangerous, dirty, disgusting fossil fuels that pollute and cost money. So he sued them, not for Oklahoma's behalf, but because he's a dick. And he sued him over and over again, and Obama finally just went around him and created the project anyway. But it took several years of court battles of him trying to do something nice from one red state to another red state. Their state governments didn't want it, didn't like it. Same thing as Bentley turning down all the money Obama was trying to give him for different projects. Then what does Trump do? He sees this eco-terrorist, Scott Pruitt, who sued the EPA over and over again and says, hey, you should be my EPA director. That would be a good fit. A man who doesn't think the EPA should exist and sued the EPA multiple times, he'd be a good EPA director. Doesn't that work and doesn't that make sense? Then you get to depression. Once you begin to realize that you can't bargain with Republicans and you can't shame them, and you can't negotiate with them, and the denial is over of saying that they care about popular opinion, then you start to think, well, Trump, I mean, he can't put Betsy DeVos as the Secretary of Education. She doesn't believe in public education, and he does anyway. Well, Scott Pruitt, he can't be EPA director. He doesn't believe in the EPA, and he does anyway. Rick Perry, when he was naming the departments that he wanted to get rid of, he named the Department of Energy. Actually, he didn't name it. Famously, he couldn't remember the name of it. He said education, and then he blanked out and didn't come up with energy. And Ron Paul was just looking at him like, what a dumbass. He even gave him a few names, and Rick Perry said, no, that's not the one. So the department he couldn't even remember the name of at the time that he was trying to say what department they should get rid of and was useless to the government, let's put him in charge of that. Ben Carson, he's famously against public housing. Let's put him in charge of HUD. That makes total sense. Rex Tillerson, he's been given a medal by Vladimir Putin. Let's put him as Secretary of State, because what could make more sense than that? Oh, wait, he's not totally as subservient as I would like him to be, so let's eventually fire him. So you begin to see a pattern over and over again. He doesn't believe in the administrative state. He doesn't want people who know what they're doing. He doesn't want people in charge of departments that actually believe those departments should exist. And that's when the depression sets in, that Republicans don't care what you think. They cannot be publicly shamed. They don't care how something looks. They don't care about appearances. They can't be bargained with. Mitch McConnell's idea of a bargain is Obama going in there and saying, hey, Mitch, why don't we just give Merrick Garland some Senate hearings? And then if people want to vote on him, No hearings. Okay, Mitch, well, for Trump's impeachment trial, why don't we go in there and we'll just have witnesses tested? No witnesses. Okay, but you see, you're being unreasonable. These things are not normal, and I don't care. Whatever. And then 6 months later, I'm going to go on Hannity, and I'm going to brag about how I obstructed everything you tried to do. And by the way, I publicly said I want you to be a one-term president. So don't expect you to be able to get anything done once I'm in the majority. How does that sound? That sounds like a pretty lousy deal, Mitch. I mean, surely there's something you want. No, there's nothing I want because my wife is a Chinese spy and I'm also called Moscow Mitch and I'm not really trying to help the country at all and I don't give a fuck about that. Also, I represent Kentucky, a state that I am not from, do not have family in, haven't lived in decades, really never truly lived in except for about 5 years between college and also when I'm running for election for the Senate for the first time. Have no real ties to and don't care about and never go to unless I'm running for re-election. So I don't care about my state. I don't care about my country. I don't care about the people of this country. And I definitely, definitely don't give a shit about you, Barack Obama, first black president, or the opposition, the Democrats, which are disgusting to me. And I would prefer palling around with Russia and China to the actual Americans that are on the opposite side of me. So how do you negotiate with that? How do you get that person to do what you want them to do? You can't. So depression sets in. Then you get to acceptance. Acceptance is the most important stage, and it's one that I think Democrats have struggled with. If you know that you cannot negotiate Republicans and you cannot win them over and there's no point trying, then it becomes, let's beat them and let's beat the shit out of them and let's put them in the minority to where they can't block us on anything. Hillary Clinton, the reason, one of the big reasons that Republicans did not want her to be the president, she was already there. Hillary Clinton lives in the space that I just described because she was there during Bill Clinton's time. Bill Clinton comes in 1992 as a centrist, so-called, you know, new Democrat, the third wave Democrat. And he comes in basically being like the Democratic Party for decades has been kind of monopolized by the far left, the Adlai Stevensons, the George McGoverns, people like that. They keep losing over and over again. Let's try something a little different, a little more popular, because we just had Reagan and George H.W. Bush for 12 years, and they beat us. And even before then, Jimmy Carter, he couldn't get anything done. And before then, you had 8 years of Nixon and Ford. And so things have been pretty grim for the Democratic Party. Let's try something a little different. And he did. And even though he was a centrist, and even though he was a very good president, the Gingrich Revolution that started in 1994 basically said Bill Clinton is the devil. No matter what he does, we must block him, we must fight him. Newt Gingrich, in a lot of ways, paved the way for somebody like Mitch McConnell to be in charge. Kind of gave him a roadmap. But Gingrich, I mean, Clinton was giving him things that he wanted. The crime bill, the repeal of Glass-Steagall. They were working on welfare reform. Bill Clinton was open to welfare reform as a Democratic president, but Republicans were so obsessed with trying to impeach him over a blowjob, they were ready to throw away welfare reform, something they've wanted forever, just to get Bill Clinton out of office and replaced with Al Gore, which you wouldn't think would make sense for them, considering Gore was going to be the nominee in 2000. He would then be an incumbent. And then you'd have an incumbent president like Al Gore running and probably would have been more likely to win. If Republicans had gotten what they wanted and gotten Bill Clinton not only impeached, because he was impeached in the House, it's just that the Senate wasn't able to convict him. They weren't able to kick him out of office. If they had gotten what they wanted, we might have been better off as Democrats. Because you would have had a lame duck president in Bill Clinton who the last 2 years of his time, he already couldn't accomplish anything. And that's not his fault at all, but he couldn't accomplish anything. But you take him out of office, even though in 1996, he beat Bob Dole by a huge margin. I mean, it was a landslide. You take a president that was democratically elected that the majority of the American people clearly won't. None of this whole popular vote, electoral vote. No, everybody wanted him. He won by every metric, very clearly won by every metric. But you take him out as a lame duck in his last year of office over a fucking blowjob, which the French or Italian president would be celebrated for. That would be half the reason they got elected. But like, hey, I got a blowjob in the Oval Office. That's aspirational at that point, my friends. Like, nobody's really going to want to kick out a president for that. What was Bill Clinton's crime? Perjury. A married man lied about getting a blowjob. Oh, wow. What a shock. I mean, really, like, come on. But you get rid of him in his last year and replace him with Al Gore. Al Gore is an incumbent president, is guaranteed re-election in 2000 because half the country's still madder than hell that Bill Clinton was thrown out the door by the Republican Party. We might have been better off if that scenario had happened. It might have really benefited us. That's where Hillary Clinton's coming from, the vast right-wing conspiracy. The fact that Republicans, they're willing to drive their party off a cliff. They are willing to basically lose everything just to kick out Bill Clinton, a centrist Democrat who went out of his way to schmooze with him and talk with him. I remember Rick Lazio was on Real Time with Bill Maher. He talked about, oh, Bill Clinton, he was so good at schmoozing. He'd say like, hey, did you catch that football game last Sunday? Come by the White House. We'll watch the game together. Come by the White House. We'll have dinner together. He said, Bill Clinton was so good at schmoozing people. Barack Obama's not good at schmoozing people. Barack Obama, he doesn't know how to do that. This is Rick Lazio saying this. The man who ran against Hillary Clinton for the New York Senate seat. The man who was for Bill Clinton's impeachment. And it's like, so you're praising praising Bill Clinton, talking about how good he was of people, at the same time that you hate his wife so bad, you're slamming her, running against her for the New York Senate seat, which he did in 2000, and you were for Bill Clinton's impeachment before that. So it's like, oh yeah, you love Bill Clinton so much when they're out of office. You see Republicans do that now. I see Republicans be like, well, if only Barack Obama, if only he were running. And I'm like, you hated Barack Obama's guts for 8 years. You made his life a living hell, no matter what he did. He wore a tan suit one time, and you went fucking ape shit. He walked out of the airplane and saluted the guy holding a cup of coffee in his hand. You went crazy. He put his feet on the desk in the Oval Office. He's a disgrace. Somewhere John Adams is rolling in his grave right now. George Washington is so happy he's dead not to be able to watch this. Things that in the era of Trump look absolutely ridiculous that Republicans criticized him for. But now that he's out of office and can't run again and is no longer a threat, oh, if only Barack Obama were running. Oh, well, you know, Joe Biden, he was Obama's vice president. A lot of things Obama, like, they're pretty compatible on. Maybe you should vote for Joe Biden. Hell no, I'm not voting for Joe Biden. And it's like, oh, right. Joe Biden is less palatable to you than Barack Obama. You're so full of shit. And that's what I think constantly when Republicans are saying this. They only like a Democrat when they're out of office. Hillary Clinton had good poll numbers. Between when she was Secretary of State and when she started running in 2016, she had great poll numbers. Everybody says, like, oh, if only Hillary, if only she'd been more like she was on the Howard Stern show, more people would like her. They would embrace her. Bullshit. When she left office as Secretary of State, she had an approval rating in the high 70s. Everybody actually liked Hillary Clinton, but she started running for 2016. And then they hated her again. Comey wouldn't have looked into her emails. And they wouldn't have looked into Benghazi. And the second she lost in 2016, where'd all that crap go? Went out the door. Nobody cared. Because they know how ridiculous it was in the first place to even look at that stuff. So because Hillary lives in the space of Republicans hate you no matter what you do, you can't win them over ever. Even right now, they say nice things about Obama only because he can't run again. When Joe Biden, when he's out of office, they'll say great things about him. If he loses in November, by next June, they'll say, oh, Joe Biden, I guess he was one of the good ones. Nobody who hates Joe Biden right now, no matter what they say, they wouldn't have preferred any Democrat. This idea that you can win over some of the Republicans, they'll be like, well, I hate Elizabeth Warren, and I hate Bernie Sanders, and I hate Buttigieg, and I mean, anybody who hates Joe Biden, there's no way they would have voted for Buttigieg or Warren. It's ridiculous. I truly believe that if they won't vote for Joe Biden this time, there's not a Democrat they would have voted for. There's not one Democrat who would have run that they would have voted for. I really do believe that. So Hillary lived in that space of, there's no sense doing the Obama thing, where the first 2 years he comes in, he wants to govern in a bipartisan way, and he has meetings with Republicans, and he talks with Obama, did all that stuff. They went and they met with the so-called Gang of Six that wanted to do bipartisan immigration reform, the Rubios and McCains and Susan Collins, and they still couldn't get it done. They went and met with Republicans over and over again about Obamacare and what to put in and what to leave out, and it was so watered down it was ridiculous compared to what they started out with. And they still couldn't get a single Republican vote. And they still took it to the courts over and over again. Republicans voted 30-something times to try to repeal Obamacare. Donald Trump runs on the promise in 2016, I'm going to repeal Obamacare, and I'm going to replace it with something bigger and better than Obamacare. Don't ask me what it is, but it'll be there. It'll be bigger than better than Obamacare. First 2 years he's president, he has a Republican Congress, Senate and House, Republican majorities in both, Republican Supreme Court. What did he replace Obamacare with? Nothing. They didn't have the votes to replace it with anything. And they knew this, but he still said that. One of the other things you might remember from 2016 when he was running, he goes, we're not going to have people dying in the street. That was another huge promise. We're not going to let people die on the street. Now we have 200,000 Americans dead from coronavirus. So yeah, I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg dying is a pretty big deal. And you can see why Democrats would fight like hell to stop a man like that from appointing her successor. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Stay tuned as I will post episode 74 shortly. Okay, thank you.